So in this session, Marie Dyson will be speaking to us. Marie's probably well known to a number of you in the room. She's an experienced consultant in the Australian disability sector. She's worked with probably most of the no-fault schemes around the country and particularly also with the ACC in New Zealand. Marie's worked closely with actuaries as well over many years to bring the fields of effective disability management and actuarial science together. And I think anyone who's worked with Marie will attest to the way that she actually understands actuaries but can translate what they say into language that other people can understand. So I'll hand over to Marie without further ado.
And it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. What I want to do today is to talk about reflections that are based on my experiences over a number of years now. And these reflections are drawn from a number of sources. I've worked in disability schemes, standard pre-NDIS disability across the country in these states. So other than Tasmania and Northern Territory, I have a reasonable sense of how it works across the country. And I've worked with insurers and insurance schemes in these states, and my work in insurance is always around the serious injury client cohort, so the brain injuries and spinal cord injuries. I also bring experience about actuarial conferencing, which is where the actuaries turn up with the reports, and we sit around the table and discuss what's in those reports. And these discussions, in my experience, have been very... they're challenging and they're interesting. They have been very much about, though, why have home modifications costs gone up and down, why have vehicle costs gone up and down, what's happening with attendant care, why is there a blowout in? Which strike me, in keeping with the change in theme of your conference, about being very micro-compensation questions and not questions about the scheme and what is sitting behind those results. So part of my presentation is about, I think, in moving to looking at schemes, things actuaries need to think about and questions they need to start to ask when they're preparing and receiving feedback on their actuarial reports. The third thing I've done is I completed a doctorate in 2000 that was about disability resource modelling. And so the particular question in my doctorate was, if I knew particular disability characteristics of children with disabilities, could I do some prediction around the quantum of therapy services? And yes, I could. And therefore, could we carve up dollars more fairly? So instead of saying you've got 10 children in your service and we'll pay you $1,000 per child, could we actually adjust it for the complexity of the child? And it did work, and it does work, and is used in Western Australia many years later to work out how they carve up their funding. At that stage, I hadn't met actuaries, but when I did, I decided it was a marriage made in heaven, because I found people who were as interested in this prediction stuff as I was, and most of my friends and family regarded my interest in prediction as vastly boring. Actuaries, I am your fan. I regard you people as 50% actuary and 50% superheroes. And generally actually smile when I say this. And one did once tell me he's used to women throwing themselves at his feet, but I didn't quite believe that. But I think you have amazing skills to bring to these businesses, and I don't think they're yet fully used. And I'd like to talk about that as well during this presentation. As I said at the beginning, my interest is particularly severe, serious injury, but let me talk for a moment about how I see these injuries as different from the typical in the workers' comp and compulsory third-party insurance schemes. First up, we accept from day one that the medical responses are very, very different, from the sore back to the head injury, and that's absolutely clear and obvious as to why that might be. The trajectories are very, very different. Even something as problematic as a broken arm, pretty soon you're out there again with your bling on doing the job. This is not the event that other sorts of injuries are interested in. So we have very different trajectories. And pretty soon after that, the insurer and your need for insurance goes away. With people with the lifetime disabilities, an acquired disability or born with a disability, the trajectory is very, very different. It is childhood, it is young adult, it is older adult. and it is old age, and that makes for a very, very different story. Certainly CTP schemes need to cope with each of those. NDIS obviously needs to cope with each of those. The workers' comp, only the last three stages. But nevertheless, the trajectories are extremely different. As you all know, the pattern of the number of claims, the costs and the liabilities are very, very different. I've presented two ends of the spectrum there, but people who have worked with the big no-fault insurers, ACC, TAC, will know that typically half of the liabilities are actually tied up with the tiny cohort of people with serious injuries. And this is part of what makes what Australia is doing in a disability insurance scheme so very, very brave indeed, because it really is taking on the very highest liability end of the spectrum. The management skills required are also very different. I see that the insurance schemes, you know, essentially have two streams in them. One is the recovery stream. To a greater or lesser extent, you get better. And so you're looking at rehabilitation for recovery is what it's about, return to work, a strong focus on cost and a very strong focus on short duration. The shorter duration, the better. In the serious injury space, you're actually looking at participation outcomes. So what are the overall life results we can achieve for this person? And that there is an end to rehabilitation. I feel concerned at times that schemes seem to, and professionals particularly, condemn people to rehabilitation for the term of their natural life. Rehabilitation is absolutely critical, up front, early, but after that it is about engagement with the community, living valued life roles. A focus on employment participation rather than return to work, and I will come back to the differences that I see between those two things shortly. It needs to be a much stronger focus on liabilities rather than costs, so you might fund a very expensive option on the basis of the liability return rather than what the cost is. An example in our field would be deciding to fund someone for a highly modified vehicle for $120,000 if you can then take out 4 or 5 hours of a care and attendant carer driving someone everywhere every week. You won't recover that in a year, you won't recover it in 2 years, in 3 years it will be neutral, in 5 you will be well in front from that sort of investment. So it's not so much, yes, cost is important, but it's not cost thinking, so you need staff who think differently. And as I said, it's lifelong management, and part of the art of lifelong management is to know when to move in and out of people's lives. And yet everywhere I look, I find insurers who persist in fitting the really high liability risk clients with the lifelong engagement to generic frequency case management. So 95% of our business is the recovery, 5% is this, and we will jam these clients into a one-size-fits-all. And you see this within businesses such as workers' compensation businesses that outsource the case management to various insurance agencies. And you also see it within businesses where they, or in the past within businesses, where they run their own in-house management of these clients. And part of my argument today is one size doesn't fit all. Why not? High financial decisions become less expert. If someone is in the position of a case manager and 90% of the decisions are around the sore back, and 10% is around the serious injury, by definition, the decisions will become less expert. The less frequently you're called upon to make a decision, the less frequently you are likely to do it well, with the regulations in the head, your policies in your head, notions about what's reasonable and necessary in your head. But it doesn't just stop at that lower level of the organisation. If we take the generic one-size-fits-all, what we generally have at the top is a claims operations manager, an operations manager, a GM, call you what them will, but they sit over the claims area. There's then a series of teams, area managers, branch managers, again, insurance managers, whatever, who report through to those people. Below them sit their teams, the bulk of whom work with those people who are going to recover with the sore backs. And they'll generally, if you're lucky, there'll be one team down at the bottom of that hierarchy that is managing the serious injury claims. When you move up the food chain for the more complex claims, the higher delegation decisions, you have quite widespread decision making across those teams and units. Therefore, the risk of inconsistent decision making increases. And I've seen this play out in disability services in regional models where, you know, in one region I can access A, B and C, in another region I can only get A and C. In one region I could manage my funding this way, in another region I can't. So the more people you bring in to the decisions, higher up the chain, the risks to the consistency of decisions increase. I want to put up an alternative model for you in that scheme thinking. Again, you've got your claims, your GM, your claims manager, whatever you want to call them. Managers reporting through who are managing a whole series of teams on those recovery clients who are more or less complex. If you then introduce within that a single team that runs serious injury with one person at that very senior level reporting through to the claims manager, the risk of inconsistent decision making has dropped significantly because one person is making all of the complex, the media risk decisions, the financial risk decisions, and they are deeply grounded in serious injury. And I will give you some evidence for this at the moment. At this stage, I'm just sharing my world views and experiences. I'd also like to then talk for a moment about non-expert models and fixes that fail. So, as I say, lots of insurers choose that generic model, one size fits all, and we'll fit serious injury around that. And after a while, they start to notice it's not working, and the liabilities are creeping out of control, and the client outcomes aren't great, and the satisfaction's pretty ordinary. So they say, oh, no, we'll get a team of expert advisors in. So the expert advisors advise and advise to their heart's content, and then managers go off and do precisely what they want to do. And why do they do precisely what they want to do? Because most of their KPIs are built around the short term, the duration, all sorts of other agendas that are understandable from where they sit. The other version of this is we will outsource our case management to a third party. So we will do the claims management, but we will outsource the case management. And there are always large providers bouncing around the edges of insurers saying we'll do your case management. My view is if you don't own the liabilities, you don't own the cases. It is impossible to march to the liabilities tune if you are in fact outsourced. So again, I'm arguing for specialist teams and structures. I'm arguing that in order to achieve success with this tiny proportion of people that crank up 50% of your liabilities, you really do need to call in specialist people. So, from that, what am I saying to actuaries about questions that I think need to be asked? I think when you come to talk with us, you need to be actually asking questions about, are there specialist cross-organisation teams working to the highest level of claims operation with these clients with brain injury and spinal cord injury? If not, the first question is why not, I think, but if not, how do you ensure expert decisions are made by experts? So people who really understand what the outcomes to be expected are, who understand the people, who understand the liability impact of their decisions. How do you ensure decision consistency across different teams if you have that very mixed model? I'm interested in knowing about how delegations are designed to actually reflect liability risk and not just costs. I get to do lots of file reviews in my work, and one of my personal favourites was a man who had quite a high spinal cord injury, and for months and months and months, the claims manager, generic claims manager, disputed whether or not this man needed once a week massage for his shoulder girdle, right? To me, it's a lay-down mazeer. If you know anything about spinal cord injury, you know pain and spasm is a problem. An hour a week, to me, was not unreasonable for someone living with a spinal cord injury. That went on for months. Overnight care was funded on the basis of one letter from an OT. Now, the liability risk associated with that was massive. Right? The liability risk associated with the massage was minimal. But why did that decision get made? Because schemes don't want to pay massage for people with sore backs every week for the rest of their lives. So the delegations really need to be aligned to the liability risks, I believe, not to the cost risks. Generic models, they get aligned to the cost risks. How do you know advisors are listened to? It's all right, we've set up a specialist advisory team, don't worry, actuaries, things are good. How do you know they're listened to? What's the line of evidence a scheme can give you that they're actually listening to their advisors and responding to those advisors? Do you have a separate conversation with the advisors as to how the strategy people, as to how they think the scheme's trucking, how they think they're being listened to, what the risks they see are emerging? Because there's the other thing I figured out about actuaries. A lot of you is about science, but the other part of you is about art as well, and business intelligence. I'd be asking questions about what are your decision failure rates? So how many of your decisions result in disputes? How many of those disputes do you lose? Okay. Claims management in recovering injuries, large claim numbers, big focus on cost, very much service-driven responses, and generally looking for a return to work outcome. Former employer is, you know, always the biggest tick of the lot. Serious injury, I'm looking at much smaller case lists. I'm looking at person-centred planning, as we would say in the disability sector, planning around people's lives. And that's because we know that there's a very, very long tail with this, and it's about the liabilities, not about the costs. And it's about planning to value life roles. It's about planning for participation, not planning to and making decisions based on services. So I'd be asking questions when I'm looking behind the numbers. What are the case lists? How big have the case lists grown? How much have they grown over the last year for everyone working with serious injury? To what extent are you asking people who specialise in serious injury to take on other complex claims? And I'm not saying other claims can't be complex, but they're not necessarily serious injury. To what extent are you diluting their efforts by the long duration, more than 2 years on workers' compensation? How do you ensure person-centred planning? It's an art. It really is an art. So what's the training? What's the supervision? What's the review processes in place? What are the triggers for more or less intensive intervention? People with lifelong disabilities need other people, the funders, to move out of their lives whenever they can. But there are critical times to come back in. So what are the triggers for that? How do you specialise within serious injury? Is it just all serious injury, or do you have... who have teams who think about younger people, older people, people who are on an employment participation path, people who are not on an employment participation path? And what evidence do you have for how effective your model is? Severe injuries are, because of the lifelong engagement, are an ageing cohort, but they can be very, very different groups within that. For example, one scheme I worked in, if I showed you all of those, which one would you say had the highest use of attendant care services? Looking at the age groups I've got there. Kids, teenagers, adults. Who's going to use most attendant care? Adults, right. Highest utilisation rates in children under 12. Was one of the problems that we had. So to me, you also need to be asking people to slice and dice their data by age groups and look at what's going on. Children have parents. Parents have supervision and care responsibilities. If your highest utilisation rates and your highest hours are tied up with your children, you have a really serious problem in how you're managing this group. Yeah? So you need to ask questions about that. Another, working with different groups, I've worked with schemes where the average age is in their 30s. That talks to me a whole lot about how family and support services and work is going to knit up. The average age is in their mid-40s. This is starting to talk to me about I've got people starting to age with a disability, and the longer they've lived with it, the worse they age, in the sense that they age younger than the rest of us do, musculoskeletal problems, all those sorts of things. And then there's another group that we just looked at recently, and they're in their late 50s. And the management there really needs to start to focus on how these people are going to be transitioned out of the income support provided by the scheme and into different schemes. Retirement planning. Do schemes with an ageing cohort actually think about retirement planning at all, or are we just hoping it'll all be all right in the long run? So I think there's a lot of stuff tied up with age that's not necessarily well explored with these clients. So, questions. What's the average age of your client cohort? What's your ageing strategy for different age groups? And this, I think, is a really critical one, is what's the average age of the primary family members for this person? So most people with disabilities live with their family. Often it's parents, sometimes it's spouses. But if mum and dad are 76 and this person's 50, how long do you think this is going to keep going for? And that is one piece of data that is very rarely captured as to how old is the primary support person for this. I think the Carers Alliance has done a good job in getting the word carers onto the national agenda, but I don't like it. I think family is family, and we really need to look at what the impact on family is and the ageing of family members. So success is actually about a focus on the liabilities and the client outcomes. So that leads me then to what sort of outcomes. Whoops, I keep leaning on the other button. Okay. With people with disabilities, is it about outcomes in valued life roles? Mark Bagshaw this morning talked about participation. That's the word we see in NDIS. That's what it's about. It's about friends, friendship, it's about ordinary activities, it's a home of your own, it's employment, it's all the sort of things that we all do and all the different roles that we occupy in life. So other questions you need to ask, what are the client outcomes? How do you measure outcomes? Because one thing I know from my experience in the sector is if people are having good and rich lives, services become less important. When you have nothing else to do, you fill your life with services, you have carers so you can have some friends. So what are the outcomes that are being achieved with this serious injury cohort? It's much more complex than just return to work. What's the evidence base for these outcomes? How do you ensure contemporary practice? Insurers I've worked with, I've seen the very best models of accommodation and support. That's where, you know, people get support where they live. And I've seen the very worst of congregate care, outdated, restrictive models of practice. So how is this company ensuring that it is actually up to date with what best practice in this field is? The data demands are very, very different. The data systems that I see insurers are typically built, understandably, on throughput data. People come in, we pay for some services, they get better. They're built on services data. I would argue that the starting point for your data in these systems actually needs to be the people themselves. You need far more information about not just age and injury, but where they live, who they live with, what other complicating factors are present. And I've actually built with a group of actuaries what we regarded as our ideal data set for one insurance scheme. And the extent to which we were then able to interrogate that data and understand in terms of clients and social factors, the extent to which our costs were being driven there was amazingly rich. So it's not about the services, it's about the people that's your primary data source. Employment. Again, the generic models focus on return to work, former job, former duties, same employer, and then there's this hierarchy of step down. Very few people with serious injuries will go back to former employer, former job. And it's not about that. It's actually about supporting people to participate in the workforce. But when you take the standard rules such as we'll fund two work trials only, we never fund transport to work, etc., etc., you won't get the good outcomes. You need people who will focus specifically on employment rather than workplace adjustments. So I'm talking vocational counsellors and rather than OTs who will talk about, you know, desks and so forth. You need to be prepared to allow people multiple attempts to get back to work. When the research tells us that people with brain injury actually go back to work quite well, but the trouble is they bounce out of the workforce again and they get on this constant churn. So how are the policies and practices in the business designed around that sort of employment participation and not you go back to work and you're okay? So there are many, many different practices, and I much prefer the term employment participation to the return to work notion, because I think return to work brings with it practices that are not appropriate to this group. So your next question is, what specialist options do you have around employment of people with disability? What adjustments do you make to what you're prepared to fund? And I'm certainly aware of many instances where people with very severe disabilities have actually been financially worse off going back to work because the rules that apply to the sore backs and the sprained shoulders and those sort of things were applied to them. And that becomes a pretty powerful disincentive, being actually worse off than you were. So does this formula work? So I've given you my reflections. I'd now like you to give you my evidence for this. Transport Accident Commission, running nearly 30 years and doing well. They started with a model of this generic case management, and in the mid-90s they looked around and went, actually, we've got a problem here. Look at all these cases that are incredibly high in the liabilities and we're not managing well. And they set up a division that works exclusively with those people, that does report to the highest level of claims management. Like all schemes, they have their ups and downs, their false starts, their good days, their bad days. But I'd cite the TAC as one piece of evidence. The other piece of evidence I would cite is my experience with the Accident Compensation Corporation in New Zealand. And at this stage, I should acknowledge two extraordinary managers I worked with. There, Liz Cairns, who is in the room, who we had the wit and wisdom to poach from New Zealand. Thank you, David. And Randall Southey, who's not here, who's a very good operations manager. But basically, we set up a model of managing serious injury to the parameters that I've talked about very briefly. Specialist services, controlled decision making, thinking about liabilities, not costs, different employment approaches, etc., etc. And I worked with them from 2012 until April this year. Over that period of time, we took that cohort of clients from an unsustainable rate of growth in liabilities. Harsh and bitter words were being spoken by actuaries at the board table. We got a $1.3 billion actuarial release, which is tap dancing. 70% of the outcomes specified for clients were being achieved. We increased the employment participation. We had the highest client satisfaction rating in the business and the lowest dispute rate. So there's my line of evidence for my reflections today, and I would argue it's fairly compelling. Finally, what are my key learnings for NDIS? And this may be a bit presumptuous, seeing the Productivity Commission was all over it too, but let me share what I think are key messages for us going forward. First of all, the NDIS is coming from a great space. It actually is coming from an understanding that they're working with people with disabilities, and it's not about throughput and sore backs and all those sorts of things. So, you know, participation, employment are clearly on the agenda. We're in a very good space there. I would like to see, as the scheme matures, specialisation to life transitions and valued roles. In the disability sector, we're very good at saying, oh, well, this is an intellectual disability services, and this is a spinal cord service, and this is an autism service. I would like us to start to think about, this is a child transitioning to school, so who are the specialists who are working in that area? This is a young person who's leaving school. What's the specialisation around that? This person wants employment. Let's look at employment options. This person is seeking support to move out of their family home and live more independently. And so we start to specialise around roles, participation, and where people are in their lives, rather than around an old medical model that says, you know, you're an intellectual disability, therefore, is one thing I would like to see. The legislation is very clear about goals. I think we very rapidly need to move from goals to a focus on outcomes, and then questions to the provider market about what's the impact of those outcomes. So you have provided all of this early intervention service. What's the actual impact? You know, do we have a positive impact on people's health and well-being? Do you positively affect the amount of attendant care they need? Have you positively affected family sustainability? Because families will always remain the backbone of supports for people. So what actually is the impact of what you've achieved? We need to take the next step and start asking for providers for evidence around that. And I think the unique data collection needs of this organisation need to be recognised. And I think they have a very tough job in actually balancing the sort of data for scheme sustainability against the human rights agenda, or with the human rights agenda. So in insurance schemes, you know, you claim your insurance, you sign a form TAC, ACC, work cover, whatever, and you say, look, you know, you can have all my data and you can share the information and you can use it for whatever purpose you like. Right? Off you go. Do your thing. In the disability sector, that is not acceptable. You know, people for too long have had too much known and shared too widely without respect for their personal information and their boundaries. But somewhere there needs to be a balance between these two things about what it is we need to keep the scheme sustainable and what it is you have a right to share, not share, and the extent to which we can use that data. I'm not saying I have an answer, but I think it's a tricky space that will need to be worked through. The other thing I would like to see in the NDIS world is moving from the traditional actuarial case conferencing to where you're asking the sort of questions that I've been suggesting you ask today, and not just the questions about why home mod's gone up and why vehicle mod's gone down. And people, you need to get to the front of the business. So often actuaries are at the back of the business. They tell us afterwards that home mods have blown or, you know, attendant care's blown. The very best value, and I think I can speak for Liz here too, that we have ever had out of actuaries is when we've been able to go and say to them, look, we've got all this client data. I know we've got 800 clients with behavioural issues because of their brain injury that are very complex. I know this is how much they're costing us in attendant care. I want to put this program in that I reckon would cost this much per person. And I think, what do we have to get a return on? How many hours of attendant care do we have to save? How many people do we need to get back into the workforce to make this work? Actuaries can tell me the answer to that. I want to introduce a specialist assessment system. I'm sick of 60 different assessment agencies giving me 60 different answers. I want 7. I want them across the country. My travel costs are going to rocket up. I know this. So where's the return on? Where's the break-even point? How much services do I need to generate a return on, generate savings on, in order to justify that? That's the best value of actuaries, and I need to say you're not at the front of the business enough, people. Every time I go into a business, I say, can I talk to the actuaries? And they say, the who? The where? Well, I think they're upstairs. You know, who's your scheme actuaries? Oh, I think it's PWs. So there needs to be a much more front foot. And I do think you're a bunch of superheroes, so I don't quite understand why that hasn't happened yet. For those of you who missed the beginning, the image about this is, I think actuaries are 50% actuary and 50% superheroes. So that's my reflections on working in serious injury insurance and some of the implications I see flowing through to the incredibly difficult job that David Bowen and his colleagues have in launching this disability insurance scheme across Australia. Thank you. I'm done.
Thanks, Marie, for a really interesting presentation. Some great questions there for us and, I guess, for management and boards as well. There's time for a few questions, so if you'd like to ask a question, if you're near the front, you can probably use this microphone if it's working. Otherwise, there's one in the middle, so just go there, and if you could say your name when you ask him a question, that'd be great. Any questions? Liz?
Liz Keynes from the... Is it working? Yeah. From the National Disability Insurance Agency. It's not a question, it's a comment. I think the three legs to the stool are absolutely what Marie said. It's actuaries being well embedded in understanding operations. It's operations well understanding what the actuaries are. But the third leg of the stool is the research component in your organisation. And when you've got that, it's a match made in heaven. So it's operations, actuaries, and whoever it is in your organisation that runs the research gig, so you've got the evidence base on the table. Fantastic presentation, thank you.
Thanks, Liz.
Anyone else got a question for Marie or a comment? Oh, yes, you're coming in. I wasn't sure if you were leaving the room or you were going to ask a question.
No, that's right. Bruce Harris from Employers Mutual. Just interested in the interaction between serious injured claims, self-insurance and workers' comp, and the NDIS. I haven't really got my head around how's that all going to play. Is that an easy question to...
Look, and in fact, David Bowen would probably be better placed to answer that, but that's going to the question of the National Injury Insurance Scheme, which is, I have no knowledge other than what I hear in gossip or in the papers from time to time. Other than, like all I've just been saying, I think if it gets merged in with throughput stuff, there will be problems. It is just such a different paradigm. One of the things I say often to people is I find it really interesting. If you look at the original legislation around TAC and ACC, they actually only envisaged two outcomes. You died or you got better. Legislatively, they never even thought about this third outcome. Now, we do have schemes like Lifetime Care New South Wales and South Australia, as we heard about this morning, who are moving in that direction and recognise that as a unique group. But the original legislation in here never even thought about this, and yet they're the biggest liability risk. And the people, I believe, to whom schemes owe most because of the severity of their injury.
No? All right. Well, in that case, I'll ask you to thank Marie again, and I'll give her a small token of appreciation.